Welcome to another installment of New Books in Military History. This is your host, Jay Lockenauer from Temple University, and I'm here today with Tarek Bakarwi, who is the author of Soldiers of Empire, Indian and British Armies in World War II, which came out with Cambridge University Press last year. Welcome, Tarek.
Thank you, Jay. It's great to be here, and thanks very much for reading my book.
It was a pleasure. Tell us a little bit about how that book came to be, what got you interested in the topic.
Well, you know, to be honest with you, it dates to back to the early 90s. I was given assignment I was working as a research assistant and working on religious conflicts in the Sudan. And I, had a bent to go far back in history and found these Sudanese slaves that had been captured by Muhammad Ali Pasha, the modernizing Ottoman viceroy of Egypt. And he'd brought in some French, some veterans of the French, the Napoleonic armies, to train them up as the only rifle-armed troops in his army. And this kind of combination of foreign or slave or colonized military manpower and modern military discipline stuck with me. And I started looking around and sort of realizing that there were many armed forces that did not fit the mold of national armed forces that I'd sort of grown up reading about, the British Army, the German Army, and the American Army. And that's really where this project originated. Why is it that people would fight for a foreign power? And what does that tell us about the nature of military service?
So I found the book really challenging just to my worldview in a way, and I want to talk to you a little bit more about that, because my work has largely been in that mold of armies somehow expressing naturally the attributes of their societies and learning about societies through studying armies. Explain to the listeners exactly how you challenge that mold.
Well, what I try and do in the book is take as ordinary an imperial multicultural army and ask of it the same questions that military sociology and military history have asked of national armies. I think one of the things that is kind of gone on with military history and military sociology is that for a lot of understandable reasons, not least that military sociology gets its start in World War II, they've taken shape within national settings, and their objects of analysis are national armies. So when they ask questions, why did this army fight? Why did it mutiny? Why did it behave this way on the battlefield? Always in the background is the explanatory resource of national society. And initially when military sociology was arguing that soldiers fight for their buddies, that organizational and psychological dynamics shape what soldiers do, this was not so important. But as people tried to grapple with the involvement of militaries in atrocity, the involvement of militaries in extracurricular battlefield violence, in race war, in treating Japanese soldiers different than they treated German soldiers, and so on, people started to turn to national society for explanatory resources for how it is that soldiers fight. They fight out of ideology, they fight out of political commitment, and they fight the way they do because of various kinds of racial categories they take from society to the battlefield. A good book in this line is Craig Cameron's American Samurai, which looked at American and Japanese soldiers and their views of each other on Guadalcanal. But in a colonial army, in a multi-ethnic army, also fighting in World War II, also fighting German and Japanese soldiers and fighting them in much the same way, these explanatory avenues to national society, like ideology and racism, simply aren't available. And they force you to think differently about the sources of battlefield behavior. It doesn't mean the Indian Army is somehow disconnected from Indian society. It means that we need to look at combinations of military and social of factors that explain the behavior of soldiers.
I was relieved to read in a couple of later places in the book that at least you let us, those of us who study Western national armies, off the hook to a certain extent by suggesting that in those contexts, it's still somewhat appropriate to talk about these national ideologies and so forth. So I don't have to just tear up all the reading that I've done.
Absolutely. I mean, I think this is one of the big misunderstandings of what post-colonial might mean in the social sciences. I think one of the things that's gone on recently is that people have turned to non-Western histories to write sort of subaltern studies or social histories of militaries that weren't Western, and to recover the voices and experience of non-Western soldiers. That's actually not what I'm doing. I take very seriously what Dipesh Chakrabarty has argued in Provincializing Europe, that Western social science is an extraordinarily rich tradition. It tells us a great deal about the things that we might want to know about. Its problem isn't that it's somehow wrong or needs to be replaced with Chinese social science or something of this kind. It needs to be supplemented with the experiences and histories of others, and to revisit our general approaches to things, which are, after all, based on the provincial experience of a few Western and European armies in military sociology and military history. So the point isn't that these things are wrong, it's that we might look at them differently if we had a broader array of history and experience to draw on, out of which to develop our general accounts. And that's sort of what I try to do in the book.
And you still rely on Durkheim fairly extensively, at least in the later sections. And I'm actually tempted to use, I'm certainly going to assign parts of this to my graduate students just to force them to grapple with this idea. But also, I think even my undergraduates will benefit. I teach a class called War and Peace, which is essentially war and society. How does culture and politics and religion influence the way different societies have fought in time? And Your discussion of ritual and training, I found really rich, and I think would help students understand the degree to which even Western armies are heavily ritualized and the impact that that has.
Yeah, it was sort of interesting to me as I developed this project. Originally began life as my PhD. I thought for sure there would be a range of studies that looked at the military through a ritual lens. And in fact, this is simply not the case. And part of this is, I think, a kind of sort of a Western view that ritual is for non-Western people. Ritual is an anthropological category that we use to study indigenous peoples, and not, as it were, to study up to the West, not something that we would use as a general category of social science when looking at modern societies. But when I look at the military, all I see are a bunch of rituals chained together. And so that's sort of one aspect of why it is I turn to really some pretty basic, I mean, the anthropologists would see me as sort of out of date to be using Durkheim, Victor Turner, and people like this. But I turn to really relatively straightforward anthropological accounts of ritual and sacrifice to try and tell us something new about the military. And one of the things it draws attention to is the way in which drill is often seen as a sort of like special Western property, not something that, drill is what Western armies do. And because Western armies do, it's not a ritual. But if you look at drill as a ritual and you just sort of understand Western drill as one particular form, you see immediately that drilled armies that practice in the way that we come to understand close order drill on the battlefield. Drill is something that was invented at many different times and places. It's not a specifically Western property, but it's a remarkable way of generating social solidarity and training troops to behave, to take the correct actions on the battlefield. And Chinese, Japanese, African armies came up with versions of drill, although, of course, it's the Western form of drill that got globalized around the world with Western imperialism. And the sort of last thing I'd say about this is that drill is the key to understanding the army as a form of social organization that is cosmopolitan in nature. Anybody can be made into a soldier. Not just Westerners, not just Germans or Americans. People from anywhere can be recruited into an army and drilled and turned into a credible infantry soldier. The discipline of the military is a cosmopolitan form of discipline.
And not exclusively modern. I mean, a couple instances you rely on Roman models or examples.
Exactly. I mean, I think while there are many specifically modern features of modern war, technology, mass production, the sheer scale of the world wars, I'm not of the view that military discipline is itself something absolutely distinctive to modernity. And there's a kind of funny move that Michel Foucault makes in Discipline and Punish, which is he uses a military discipline as the model of modern discipline. But he points out that this form of disciplining soldiers is something that goes way back into the ancient world. And as we know, it's the recovery of ancient military manuals that reintroduces disciplined foot soldiers into Europe in the early modern period, or that is part of reintroducing infantry soldiers into Europe. So the forms of discipline themselves are very old, and they're very broadly applicable. And this is why it is that this category of ritual seems to me to be a more effective way of thinking about military discipline than the notion that it's either Western or specifically modern.
So are we back then simply to thinking about primary groups? In other words, the allegiance, the group solidarity that's a function of these drills, kind of independent of ideology?
Well, along with many analysts of the military, it seems to me very clear that group solidarity is absolutely essential to fighting effectively in regular militaries. And so I would not in any way want to dismiss entirely the notion that soldiers form very tight bonds of comradeship in and through training, and that they draw on these bonds on the battlefield in a variety of ways. However, as Omar Bartov and others have pointed out, there's a kind of fatal ambiguity to the primary group. I mean, if soldiers fight for their buddies, why are you fighting at all? I mean, take your buddy and get off the battlefield. A primary group can be the basis for organizing a mutiny, for various forms of battlefield indiscipline, like hiding together or going on a patrol, hiding somewhere, and then coming back with a fake report. Group solidarity or buddies doesn't explain why it is that soldiers might fight particularly hard, why they might be willing to lose those buddies, why they might be willing to lose other buddies in collecting the blood debts of those who have already died. So I think we need additional resources to, as it were, point the primary groups in the right direction or explain why it is that they fight to the point of annihilation. And this is where it is that many military historians and to a lesser degree, military sociologists have turned to ideology, to ethnicity, to race hate, to explain why it is that primary groups direct their violence towards the enemy.
Yeah, you make this point in a way slightly different, I think, in the book, but you point out the irony that casualties can actually increase group solidarity. They don't necessarily erode the primary group in the way that people understand it somewhat simply.
It's a sort of stock feature of the cohesion or combat motivation group debate that casualties are a problem for combat motivation. And this, it seems to me, has always got this exactly the other way around. There's nothing quite as bloodthirsty as a unit, a well-trained unit that has suffered casualties. They are looking for payback. And that dynamic of inflicting blood debt on the enemy inflicting blood debt on you, is a kind of circuit of battlefield violence that once it gets going, can generate resources on its own for the continuation of battle. You don't necessarily need, as it were, ideology or something you're fighting for back home. The thing begins to take on a life of its own. And so I think seeing casualties not as a problem for cohesion, but constructing them as sacrifices in the way that anthropologists do, and a sacrifice, as an anthropologist will tell you, is always about the building of social solidarity. A group is never more alive as a group than when it's lost a member and it's mourning.
So let's talk a little bit about the specifics of the book, because the title seems to indicate that it's incredibly broad, the Indian and British armies of World War II. It's really focused on Burma, though. And I found that fascinating, partly because I don't know much about the Burma campaign. So tell us a little bit about how that either shapes your argument or about your contribution in that area.
Thank you. Thank you, Jay. So I titled it broadly, in part to appeal broadly and to make sure that World War II got in the title. Burma, I think, is particularly interesting because it's kind of a collection of all of these different people from different ethnicities, different empires, different nations who are fighting this, very vicious infantry war in really a very difficult terrain. I mean, parts of Burma have plains and are flat, but where a lot of the fighting occurred is on jungle-covered ridges. And it offers an opportunity to see how people from very different social and ethnic backgrounds came to be fighting one another in very similar ways. Or not. But the fact is that they did. And Indian peasants end up fighting the Japanese in ways not dissimilar to American Marines on Guadalcanal. Yet, of course, those Indians hail from a very different background. So Burma enabled me to have a kind of sort of natural historical experiment where you could see how it was that people from different backgrounds came to fight in very similar ways. It's very interesting. It doesn't register very much in the U.S. It's just China, Burma, India, and you think immediately Stillwell and the nationalist Chinese. But for Britain, the Burma campaign is the main Pacific War campaign that they were involved in. And most of the fighting in Burma and most of the troops in Burma were British Imperial troops and Indian Army in particular, with the British Army very much as a minority force.
And of course, it wasn't just ethnically diverse on the Allied side. You point out that the Japanese had not only Koreans working or fighting for them, but also Indians in the Indian National Army.
That's right. Of course, like everywhere the Japanese went, there were lots of Koreans in the IJA. But the Japanese also raised national independence forces from the colonies that they liberated. And the largest and most successful of these was indeed the Indian National Army that was primarily recruited out of Indian prisoners captured after the Malayan and the Malayan campaign and the fall of Singapore. So it enabled you, as it were, to see the Japanese Indian Army and the British Indian Army facing off against one another. And again, this sort of comparative case dimension of the Burma campaign comes to the fore.
And of course, the context of Indian nationalism and in the independence movement is critical for that story.
Absolutely. Sorry, my screen went out there. I mean, that is the counterpart to the national society of national armies. What the Indian Army had back home was colonized Indian society. Indian society, of course, was the site of the world's most advanced anti-colonial movement of the time, the Indian National Congress. And it was also the site of major famine during the Second World War and a very complex relationships between the British and the different and the communal organization of its Indian Empire. So this is not a national society, as it were, mobilized and standing unified behind an army in the way that we imagine a national army. And yet, despite all of this, and despite the recruitment into the Indian Army of Indian officers, almost all of whom were nationalist and wanted independence for India after the war, despite this, the Indian Army, for the most part, fights relatively well. It is an effective and very large, over 2 million men at one point, fighting force for the British Empire, even at this late date in the history of formal empire.
And that just puts the finest point, I think, on your overall argument about the kind of surprising willingness of these soldiers to fight. Is not only are they're not fighting for their own country, in some ways they're fighting for their oppressor, but they're also, you mentioned the famine, they're also concerned about their families. They have not only personal reasons maybe to want to escape the violence, but to go home and protect and provide for their families.
Yes, it's I think one of the things that comes out in Soldiers of Empire is to sort of try to break down this distinction between soldier and mercenary. You know, one of the ways that we think about that distinction is that soldiers fight for their own people. Mercenaries are in the hire of a private company or a foreign power for pay. But, you know, the Latin derivation of soldier is one who fights for pay. And as one of my Indian officers remarks, I think he was in the Western Desert campaign. He said, "I don't see anyone out here who's serving without pay. They all look like mercenaries. If you're going to call us mercenaries." So the Indian Army, like all armies, had a material base that allowed its soldiers to do what they did. And what the British did was to protect the Indian Army recruiting grounds from the worst of the famine. And moreover, precisely because there was famine in India and the Indian Army is recruited from rural areas, for many Indian soldiers, it would have been more profitable to be at home growing grain than it would have been to be off at war. Nonetheless, the army was seen as a place where you would get three meals a day and a paycheck in a situation of economic and food insecurity in the Raj during the war.
So the other thing that you tackle early in the book, at least, is the whole notion of the creation of the Indian Army and in some ways of Indian society by the colonial power and for the benefit of the colonial power. And this is in your discussion of the whole martial races idea.
Yeah, I mean, this is where I take on the kind of headline organization of military sociology, which it asks, is it army or society, is most significant in creating soldiers and making them fight? And I would say here that even though the debate is sort of set up that way, I think most military historians and military sociology, if you said, is it army or society that shapes a soldier, they would say both. Yet they still want to think about these things in two different categories. Over here are the social factors, and over here are the things they pick up in the army. And instead, what I look at in the book is the way in which the army took a set of cultural and ethnic ideas from civil society, and using military discipline, instilled it in the troops that they created. And it's in this way that the martial races come to have existence as a particular ethnic group. The kind of classic example here is the Sikhs, who are known as a warrior people in large measure because for so many years, for a century, they were recruited in very large numbers as a percentage of population by the Indian Army, and are instilled in with a warlike version of their own ethnic identity. Sikhs are warlike because they're in the army, and these identities then begin to bleed out into civil society. They become a basis upon which Indians seek to negotiate with the British. You know, we want a better part in the army, or we want to be able to have this particular menu of food or whatever it is, because this is what our religion demands. So ethnicity becomes something that is produced in and through the Indian Army rather than something that pre-exists the Indian Army in the way one would think about, oh, there were martial races out in society and we just went and recruited them. The martial races were a creation of the Indian Army, and through that went on to play roles in Indian society.
It was fascinating to see these groups. I mean, you mentioned in terms of the issue of primary group, how that group solidarity could bite the army in terms of it could be the basis for a mutiny. These martial races could then struggle against each other for promotions. I mean, literally for hardcore benefits, pay, promotion, conditions.
What the Indian Army did, all of this is in a way the martial races is a reaction to the Indian mutiny. And the perception of the Indian mutiny one of the responses to the Indian mutiny was that we have to find ways to make sure that the soldiers that we're employing to defend our empire don't get together and form an Indian nation. And so we want to divide and rule the soldiers within the army. And this is where it is that martial races really becomes normative in the Indian Army, a way of dividing and ruling the army so that it doesn't join against the colonizers. But once you organize the army in these sort of stovepiped arrangements, and it's probably worth explaining to listeners that this was an army that divided and ruled itself down to the battalion level. Each company in an Indian Army battalion would be from a different martial race, a Pathan company, a Dogra company, a Sikh company. And each company would grow its own junior officers. And then above those junior officers are a kind of intermediary class of warrant officer called the Viceroy Commissioned Officers. And these were really the key people in the battalion. And they were also grew out of each class. And it's these NCO and VCO slots and the pay and power and perks that went with them that the different martial races in a battalion would fight over. And this becomes particularly problematic the minute you go into a high-intensity war situation. The Indian Army is set up to fight frontier war, imperial war. And if you lose, you know, 15 Pathans one day, there are likely to be 15 Pathans coming up through your replacement system to slot into that company. But if you're fighting the Japanese or the Germans and you lose half the Pathan company one afternoon, and also all the NCOs and maybe also the British officers who speak the appropriate language, the replacement system simply couldn't keep up with this. So they started having to add different martial races into companies composed of other martial races. And this is the point at which, if you're a kind of British Orientalist, you think, well, the natives aren't going to get along. We can't put Hindu and Muslim troops together in the same company, or two different kinds of Hindu troops, or Sikhs and Muslims together. It'll be chaos. But it turned out that officers, by and large, made this work. And they made it work through pretty sensible kinds of simple things, like making sure that the larger group wasn't able to victimize the soldiers of the minority group, or promoting NCOs from the minority group so that they had representation within the company. So this sort of experience of mixing together different martial races in the same companies under pressure of war convinced a lot of people involved in this, both Indian and British, that this stuff about the martial races didn't really make any sense. It was actually, as it were, as some of them say, retarding progress, making Indians more tribal rather than less tribal by enforcing this kind of discipline, as quite a few British officers were commenting by the end of the war.
Well, this is a good point just to emphasize the strength of the book in terms of the tactical descriptions too, because the point you just made about casualties, I mean, it mattered which company was at the side of the box that the Japanese attacked. I mean, they could get wiped out quite easily, which made World War II a different kind of a conflict for an army that's constructed in this way. So that's not really a question, but just an observation. One of the things that I also was going through my mind as a German historian was what we think we know about the Habsburg army, right? And I know I'm going to kind of embarrass myself and oversimplify, but the notion that nationalism disintegrates the Austro-Hungarian army and therefore the Habsburg Empire, the example that you show us maybe makes us rethink that didn't necessarily need to happen, that there were things happening within the army itself that would have generated these kinds of solidarities independent of ethnic conflicts.
You know, it's interesting you mentioned the Habsburgs, because on several of occasions when I presented work from this project, people have mentioned the Habsburg army. And I've delved into it a very little bit, but I'm not very knowledgeable. But the general kind of point that I think comes out of this is that the minute you start looking around for multi-ethnic armies fighting in high-intensity situations, you find quite a lot of them. And one of those armies, of course, is the British Army, which throughout the modern era has made very large use of Irish troops from both sides of the border, both Protestant and Catholic, both sides of the Northern Irish border. So even in the midst of World War I and World War II, when Irish anti-British feeling is running very high, and there, wars for Irish independence, you still have very large numbers of Irish soldiers in the British Army. Same thing as I discuss in the book with a Welsh battalion that I look at in some detail at the end of the volume. And for all of these kinds of groups, their political stakes of the war are not the same as it is for the primary national power. Yet the army still seems to manage. So we have to look for other sources of why it is that soldiers keep fighting. And one of the things I develop in the book is this notion of the structure of battle, the ways in which particular kinds of battlefields and campaigns have features which, as it were, kind of lock soldiers into a cycle of combat. In Burma and everywhere the Japanese were encountered, the problem of surrender, the fact that surrender was shut down as an exit valve. You couldn't just sort of throw your hands up. People fought to the very end, and even the wounded would try to take one more with them, in part because they thought on both sides that if they surrendered, they wouldn't be allowed to. They'd be killed anyway, so you might as well go out fighting. Another feature of the structure of battle in Burma that is very significant is jungle terrain. Encounters often took place in conditions of surprise and very close range. And so the fight takes on a kill or be killed nature. In the book, I also lay out as kind of basic combat the attack on a perimeter and the way in which in a perimeter, everyone is going to stand or fall together. If the enemy gets inside that perimeter, you're all going to end up in a bad way. And so there's a kind of pressure on everybody to fight together in order to survive. This perimeter is also what it is that people like Victor Davis Anson argue works in a phalanx. As long as everyone stays together, you're more likely to come out of the battle alive than not. So paradoxically, the army and the battlefield have conspired to create a situation that the way to survive is to fight hard. And that is to sort of put survival as the motivation for combat. Now, that's a pretty interesting trick that the military plays on people, but it's a very different kind of argument than the turn back to this idea that people are fighting out of ideological or political commitment, and they're somehow able to sort of, you know, push down the fear in their bodies because they're committed to this ideal goal. I just don't think people in large measure, in large numbers, in mass armies, can function in that kind of sort of mind over body way.
So you've been working on this project for a long time. You said it began in the 1990s. What are you going to work on next? Or what are you working on now?
Well, what I'm working on now is, I think I should sort of say which may be of some interest to your listeners, that, you know, I made this horrible mistake and I went and did my PhD in a political science department because I'd had a master's degree in IR, which in Britain is in international relations, is very historical and multidisciplinary. And international relations is located in political science in the US. So I sort of rocked up at a political science department and my, you know, fellow students had projects that sounded like physics textbooks. You know, so anyways, I say that by way of saying that my work is becoming increasingly archival and historical, and I really don't fit within a political science international relations discipline anymore. So that's by long-winded way of saying that my next project is on the first year of the Korean War. And the question that I'm interested in is how it is that American soldiers and officers made sense of suffering defeats and military setbacks at the hands of people that they regarded as racially inferior. You'll know, Jay, that some of this is coming out of the final chapters of Soldiers of Empire, where I look at some of the processes of how it is that the histories of battles are written. And I observe that many battle histories are written by veterans. This is a kind of long-running tradition of battle kind of calling for its own history, and the people who participated in it go home, and they don't only write memoirs, they also write researched histories. And we sometimes dismiss this as drums and trumpets, military history. It's the kind of military history that military historians and universities are not supposed to do. because it's the, you know, story of combats and heroes and you know, why this platoon was over there and not over here, and not the story of social forces and institutions that we're supposed to be telling in proper academic history. But I want to revisit what kind of history is battle history as a form of public history, you know, which is read far more widely than academic military histories, but also as a form of insider discourse where soldiers come home from battle. They're often extremely aggrieved, especially if you were in Korea. And then they research and write texts which become very significant battle histories. An example from Korea is T.R. Fehrenbach's This Kind of War, which had a long run as a bantam war book, as a text on officers' reading lists and in staff college. And it was just mentioned again recently by Mattis that as something we should read if we're contemplating a war in Korea. So this is a very significant text, but it's not a normal kind of history. So what kind of history is this? And that's the sort of question that I want to ask. And the book that I've found most kind of inspiring to think about this question is Dipesh Chakravarti's The Calling for History, which is an account of a very prominent Indian historian who operated entirely outside the academy. In the last, beginning in the 1890s up through British Indian independence. And he writes history. It's Sarkar is his name, and it's sort of not important who he is. But what kind of history is history conducted outside of the academy? How does that become socially meaningful? What is the research process? And what will this tell us about what happens in battles, with battles in their journey from an event to being written up in a history like this? Sorry for the long-winded answer there.
No, that's very, very helpful. I mean, one of the things that I try to do at the end of an interview is to ask for a recommendation for a book to read, either because I want to interview the author or just for my edification. So now maybe we have that recommendation already. Well, thanks for your time. This has been a fascinating interview. I think we'll sign off here. And thanks again. I highly recommend this book.
Thank you very much, Jay. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
This is Jay Lockenauer, hoping you enjoyed listening to Tarak Barkawi discuss his new book, Soldiers of Empire, The Indian and British Armies in World War II, that was released by Cambridge University Press in 2017. Come back again.